Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about Eclipse Che, the ultimate in your IDE environment. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 419, recorded January 31st, 2017, Eclipse Che. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise, open-source, continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. To learn more about GoCD, visit gocd.io/twit for a free download. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free Libre open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and unaware of it, projects you may want to download right after the show and go play with it. Not while you're driving, though. Be sure you first pull up to a convenient spot. Joining me today, once again, is Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here. And I may or may not have ever SSH'd into a server while driving. No, I haven't done anything like that ever, of course.
And so I am speaking to you from, again, my brother's place, just like a couple weeks ago. We taped this last. And just before we started the show, oh, my God, he's moved closer. There is a deer, like two deers, actually. Two deers, whatever. Right deer outside eye. The window. Yeah. Deer eye. Right. Exactly. And they're wandering around. Hopefully my housemate's dog is not going to need to go out anytime soon, although I'm surprised I'm not hearing barking just now. But it's so really, really, really cool because I'm up here sort of north of Olympia, south of Seattle, having a great time. And Jonathan, we're speaking to you in the normal location, I presume?
Yes, the flyover state of Oklahoma. I'm here at corporate headquarters, the home office in Lawton, Oklahoma.
Yeah, cool. All right, it's wonderful. All right, and it's been so long since we've talked. I just realized as I was sound checking last show that you were also the co-host just 2 weeks ago when we last did our show. So welcome back.
This is what happens when I set my own schedule. Whenever you ask if I'm available, it's like, yeah, I can be available.
Absolutely awesome. And I apologize for last week's cancellation, but our guest has been we're getting him rescheduled, but he had some sort of internet provider that sort of sounds like apparently mangled his internet connection and did not give him an appointment until Wednesday. So really, it's not going to make a Tuesday taping work very well. So we will bring him back, though. We will definitely bring him back. We just need to get him back on the schedule. But let's talk about this week's show. Eclipse Che, something close to that. I'm probably mispronouncing that. But so let's back up a second and talk about what this is about. Eclipse is an IDE, been around for quite a while. Open source IDE. But one of the things about it being an IDE, and let me also explain briefly what an IDE is, it's the thing you interact with as you are programming, debugging, developing, sometimes even deploying, basically handling all the interactions you have with programming languages. Eclipse, I believe, is written in Java and was originally developed to basically be a Java IDE. Because heaven knows, Java needs strong IDEs because it's such a crappy language. Did I say that out loud? I did say that out loud. But over time, of course, Eclipse has had more interactions, support for more languages like JavaScript, HTML, things like that. And so it's become really sort of one of the two main big workhorses written in Java to deal with Java and all the other families of languages. The other one being, and this is a Emacs versus VI argument here, but the other one being, of course, IDEA, originally called IntelliJ, which is part proprietary, part open source, and that's a whole another ball of wax. And whether IDEA is better or whether Eclipse is better is one of these arguments that we could spend forever discussing. It may come up at least once in the show. If not, let me just say, without a doubt, Emacs is better. Okay, so either of these are going to be anything great. So
Emacs is the better IDE. Is that what you're saying?
Emacs is my favorite IDE. I need nothing else. It seems to work really well for me. If someone would have actually probably put Emacs bindings on Eclipse or IntelliJ, I may actually be able to use it. But without the Emacs bindings, I'm really, really, really lost. So anyway, that's Eclipse. I just talked about Eclipse, which is sort of like just the basic setup. But one of the things that has sort of plagued us in doing something like this, or sort of been one of the troublesome things, is being a developer is more than just, you know, what text editor you're interacting with. It's also the environment in which your system runs. It includes things like your runtime, things that are installed, like now Docker is sort of cleaning up some of that, and these other container solutions are coming along, helping some of that. But there really isn't something that sort of lets you be developed no matter where and what you're setting up. And so Eclipse Che started a few years ago. And of course, our guest, Tyler Jewell, will have a lot more to say about that in a few minutes. But basically brings together all the pieces in sort of a soup to nuts solution so that your editor, your debugger, your runtime system, your deployment system, your change control system and stuff can all live together. Not only all live together, but they can run locally or they can run on a server. One of the key features of this is that you can actually do open source development without installing anything, a no install solution, and all of a sudden you have an up and running IDE that can help you write slightly better Java code or anything like that. Poor people with Java. I'm sorry. I'm really going to be dissing Java a lot today. I hate Java. And in case that wasn't clear, I do hate Java. Jonathan, you want to fill in a little bit about what you know about this so far and doing the research for the show?
I've worked with IDEs before. I've not worked much with Eclipse, and I don't know a whole lot about this project, so I'm looking forward to learning about it. I am wondering, though, whether they have a problem with low-quality pull requests, because once you kind of lower the barrier of entry that says you just have to have a browser to be able to compile this and you know, do a pull commit, I wonder if they get these drive-by commits that are of lesser quality in some of their projects. And I'm curious to hear how that works together. One more thing that's interesting is this is kind of a browser as an OS in the way it presents it to the user. We're kind of getting into the browser as an operating system, browser as a platform mindset with this, which is really interesting.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, the deer just walked right by the window. So I was like, okay, I am distracted by this. I should go close all the windows before we continue the show. But I don't normally have this kind of access except in a zoo. So this is really kind of cool. Anyway, enough of that. Enough of that. The show is not about this week in deer hunting or whatever. This show is about PLOS open source software. So I am going to continue. But before we bring our guest on today, let me go ahead and bring you a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by GoCD. GoCD is the on-premise, open-source, continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks. With GoCD's comprehensive pipeline modeling, you can model complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. With its parallel and sequential execution, GoCD can easily configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment. The value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance. GoCD's real power is in the visibility it provides over your end-to-end workflow, so you get complete control of and visibility into all your deployments across the organization. GoCD also offers complete customization for your software's individual needs. GoCD will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks. Their test reporting will tell you exactly which change set and on what platform a test started breaking. Say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is the best continuous integration and deployment tool you've probably never heard of. To learn more about GoCD and for a free download, visit gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guests. Tyler Jewell, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Very cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I am from sunny San Francisco in California.
Ah, sunny San Francisco. And I've been reading about climate change recently, and apparently they're going to have to rebuild San Francisco Airport soon. That'll be really bizarre. But
we have too much wind and too much rain.
I know. Very, very crazy. Okay, so I sort of gave my 30,000-foot view of what I think this is all about, including my disdain for Java, but let's just keep that aside for a while, I guess. Tell me, what problem are you finding that Eclipse Shea is solving, and am I pronouncing that right?
You're pronouncing it absolutely correct. And Eclipse Shea is a developer workspace server and a cloud IDE. And the problem that it solves is to allow anyone anywhere the opportunity to contribute to a software project without having to install software first. And you very much characterized the problem accurately earlier, which is if you want to be a developer on any project, you need to have a whole series of utilities configured and ready to go. There is your production runtime from that project. You're going to need a debugger. You're probably going to need some sort of IntelliSense from a language server that provides things like code complete and syntax highlighting. You need an editor, right? You're going to need to be the ability to compile the code, which is going to require a specialized dev runtime. You might need SSH access, FTP, whatever those utilities are. And you have to set these things up. And that process is manual, it's error prone, and it's very challenging. And a developer workspace server encapsulates all of that into a single workspace. And with Che, when you create a workspace, we include the runtime for your project, all of its utilities. They're installed with Docker, the debugger, the IntelliSense, and run it off into the cloud or on a server that you host yourself, and then give users access to it either through a browser IDE that is served up from within your workspace or from IntelliJ or Eclipse or one of those awful IDEs that you refuse to use, including Emacs, by SSHing directly back into the workspace that is set up. Emacs forever, Control-K is my favorite key combination.
Yes. And you probably still have in muscle memory the stuttering for Control-K to keep deleting consecutive lines, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just like even my middle finger is just sitting there kind of like a bunny rabbit.
Yeah. It's such a really. Now we're getting it off on this week in editors. No. So let me characterize it again, just to make sure that we're all on the same page here. So, as a real life example, one of my clients, Insight Cruises, I develop code for them that lives in the cloud, runs on FreeBSD systems, now to be migrating over to some Linux systems on AWS. But for a while, it's been FreeBSD systems. Well, okay, so I've got Perl installed there, I've got Apache installed there, and I have a number of other tools around that to be able to produce these web pages and record the clients, signing up for cruises, things like that. But when we develop, we're developing on localhost, as we call it, which is now I'm running on OS 10, yep. So I'm using Mac ports to install roughly the same Perl modules. I have a different Apache and different configuration files required. And so I have this constant shifting back and forth as I take the code and I hope it's going to work exactly the same way in the cloud. So would you say that's a typical setup problem for people? And so how is Che precisely solving this?
It's a very typical problem. It's commonplace, and this problem materializes at any time you want to take a production system and then create a development environment locally. It happens when you want to move from maybe your work computer to your home computer and you want to pick up the work that you left off. And it also happens among teams where you have a team leader who is trying to delegate work to different individuals that need to have identical systems. Or even in the open source arena, if you have an open source project and you're trying to build your contributor base, you need to make it simple for those contributors to get a development environment set up. And so the approach that we took to solve this is to say, let's redefine the workspace. Historically, if you get a desktop IDE on localhost, the workspace is contained to the files of your project, the code, and then the linkages of that code to your localhost system. And we said that that abstraction is the wrong one. The workspace in our world needs to not only include the code, but all of its dependencies. So that when you come into Che and say, give me a workspace, that workspace goes through an activation process so that when it is up and running and we verify that it's running, the code is there, all of its dependencies to compile it and debug it are there, and it has a runtime so that it's running in it. And that is, and then there's also a browser IDE that is inside of it and hosted from within the workspace. So the workspace activation process verifies all those dependencies, whatever they may be, installs them if necessary, configures them if appropriate, hosts the web IDE, and then just gives back to the user, hey, here's a URL, click on it and you can get to town. Or if you want to, you can upload an SSH key and then connect your desktop IDE and go.
So I want to jump in and ask something here. This is something I was wondering about before, and it kind of plays off of what Randall had to say, where he's got this situation where he develops on his Mac with one version of Apache and, you know, certain Perl libs, and then goes to this BSD machine with a different version of Apache, and he's faced with this situation where he has to make his code work in both places. Doesn't that make for better and more portable code when you're forced to make it work in this machine and in this machine? And can we run into a situation with a shared IDE that, yes, we've got really, really good code as long as you're running exactly these binaries, but as soon as you go to move it to something else, everything breaks?
So that problem is a very legitimate problem, but it is handled in this world. So in our world, if I were to give you the kind of the mock-up of what is contained in a workspace, our workspace is a combination of an IDE that needs to be hosted within it, your code, and then a set of runtimes that we call environments. Your workspace can have multiple runtimes inside of it. Now, the default one we give to you is a Docker-based set of runtimes. And so we create these containers from images, but it could be a VM-based or an SSH-based. And so what it allows is for you to have a single workspace, but you can actually switch from runtime to runtime, with each runtime being a different OS, which would then dictate a different set of configuration and dependencies. So without having to swap out the code, or without having to swap out the IDE, this self-hosted workspace can change runtimes for the developer, all within that server.
Does Eclipse Che have some continuous integration style testing to where I can write code once and then say, all right, I want you to test it on this workspace, and this workspace. Tell me if it breaks on either of them.
That's a great idea. No, we haven't gotten to that level of, yet. What we do have, though, is the construction of these runtimes can oftentimes be very challenging. So, when you ask a developer, what do you need your runtime to be? They'll say, well, you know, I'm going to either have some sort of templated Docker file. It might be a compose file, so it's going to be a multi-container runtime. Or it could be like a Vagrant VM, which is going to have different base images to pull from. So the process of just creating these runtimes and testing them against your code is a bit of a bear. And we have utilities in the product to let you author the recipes for these runtimes, build them, run them, inject your code, test it before you open the IDE to go into, hey, now I want a full debugging IntelliSense experience on that.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit to project history. So how did this get started? Whose itch was being scratched that needed to be scratched correctly? Is that even correct grammar? Anyway, make something up. Make a question about it.
Is it possible to scratch an itch incorrectly, right? So that's the question here, right?
If you start bleeding, you may have done it wrong.
So this this story for me started back in 2010. So in 2010, I was working as a VP of product management at Quest Software. This was the one that bought by Dell. And I was an executive in management, and I was not technical anymore. And I got sick for 9 months. I had done, knock on wood, too much recreational drug use. And kids don't do drugs. And anyways, it had ruined my cognitive ability for about 3 months. I eventually self-diagnosed, and I got better. And on the other side of getting better, I was a little disillusioned with the work that I was doing, and I wanted to reacquire my technology skills. I was actually at one point in time a very good Java developer. I had written 3 books in Java. Randall, eat that. and I missed that comfort and that feeling and that confidence that came from being an expert in a programming language. And it had completely gone. The world had moved on past me. And so one day I decided I was going to reacquire this. And I sat down and I was going to download the world's most popular IDE, which was Eclipse at the time, the most popular application server, which was Tomcat. And I was going to do this sample application, the pet store, which was very common back when I came from, you know, when I was doing Java. And I just wanted to compile it, edit it, and get it going again with modern day technologies. And I couldn't get the IDE installed. I couldn't get the code to compile. I couldn't get the sample application to run. And I spent 2 days on this. And I was pretty humiliated. I was embarrassed, right? I'm classically trained in computer science. I had worked as a software engineer. I was frustrated and humiliated at the time. And it was in that, you know, moment of frustration where I was just like, crap, there should just be a link on a browser page. I should be able to click that link, and then behind that link should have all the intelligence necessary to create this environment so that all that other dev infrastructure is just handled for me, and I can then focus on what I want to focus on, which is writing some code, compiling it, playing with these experiments with that. And so from that, I recognized that cloud IDEs were going to be the way to solve that. They weren't an IDE for a developer to me. They were a way to use cloud resources to automate dev infrastructure. And so in 2012, I created CodeEnvy, which was a commercial company, and you may have heard of CodeEnvy.com. And we had started building a cloud IDE out in the cloud, and it was meant for end user developers. And we realized about a year into the company that in order for this cloud IDE technology to really become mainstream, we needed it to be adopted by a broader ecosystem of software vendors. You know, vendors like Red Hat and Samsung and SAP, because there was so much capabilities that developers needed in a cloud IDE for it to be useful, and we were never going to be able to do it on our own. And so we started realizing that open source was going to be the way, and we wanted to find a way to either open source all of CodeEnvy or at least the material aspects of it so that we could develop an ecosystem, build partnerships, and find a way to collaborate on a core that was reusable by many other commercial entities along with ourselves. And we met the executives at the Eclipse Foundation, and they had some side projects on this, and we were primarily targeting Java and compiled languages with our system, and it was like a match made in heaven. This was a gap that they had. They were very supportive of what it takes to build ecosystem and to build an open source project. And so we went through this exercise of saying, hey, you know, Eclipse Che could be a single server version of what we ship at CodeEnvy at CodeEnvy.io. We gutted that out. We started that work in beginning of 2014. It took us a year and a half, almost 2 years, to migrate it over and then to do the IP checks, the copyright transfer, all the sort of stuff that you need to do. And we kind of refactored it a couple times along the way. And at the beginning of 2016, we made a GA release. We had gotten some free publicity with people who were going, what is this witchcraft going on out there? And the traffic took off. And in the past year, in the year that it's been public, about a year ago, we were getting about 1,000 usage hours a day from our telemetry. And yesterday, it was 25,000 hours. Right. So Che, the usage has really taken off. And at this point in time, there were 70 contributors on our last release, and some really impressive companies, including Docker and Red Hat, SAP, Samsung, IBM, and whatnot on it.
Okay, so how does this fit into the development cycle for a given like a team? Okay, so let's say ZipRecruiter, my primary client right now. We've all got Vagrant local images, or some of us have, because I can never get Vagrant to work right on my machine. Some of us have EC2 boxes that have a lot of the same deploy controlled by some wonderful Perl scripts and stuff.
Yep.
Managing, to put things in. What would the migration be like from something like this from what we currently have, which is a ragtag, you know, fugitive, whatever they call it, ships. I forget the yeah. stuff from Battlestar Galactica. How would we get from here to there? And what would it look like eventually then for our interaction with other developers, with QA, with production? Yep. How does that change with Eclipse Shay that makes it all wonderful?
So we have seen the migration take place in a few stages and a few steps, and it's a very natural progression. So the first step is that we get a lot of individual developers who are just standing up their own workspace server with Che so that they can transfer their work, their own personal work, from machine to machine or from home to work and whatnot on that. And that gets them in the habit of defining their workspaces, making sure they have good runtime recipes, that their code compiles. And that's a big part of it, because you'd be surprised at how many assumptions we make as developers about localhost. And when you start standing up a workspace server, you have to break all those assumptions that you've built in over a number of years, and you have to rethink how you structure your workspace a little bit so that you can get this portability and this shareability access. Once you've done that for the individual, then you start tying this into your continuous integration system. Now, in our world, because our default runtimes are Docker containers or compose files, you can have parity between the runtimes that you use in development and those that you push out onto Kubernetes or OpenShift or whatever other orchestrator that you've got, or if you're using VMs as well. So we go to great lengths to take all the dev mode stuff that we do, with like the debugger, the SSH, all the web terminal, all this stuff are agents that we inject into the runtime after the fact. So you can maintain total parity, and you set that up so that you can develop on the production runtime, and then you can push it to the production runtime and go back and forth. Then the next step is you say, okay, if I'm a team leader or I'm a maintainer or I'm running a project team, whatever that may be, hey, okay, how do I collectively get my group of contributors to collaborate more effectively together? So you can set up one of these servers, you can have then shared workspaces, but even more powerfully, these workspaces make sense when you integrate them into your issue management or version control. So mm-hmm. We have a Jira adapter, and if you're using Jira, and what it does is that when you're looking at your issues, it detects the branch, and it automatically generates a workspace dedicated to that branch with exactly the runtimes that are needed and that branch's code on that. And so you can have a workspace per branch. You know, so now users can just go into Jira, they can see a link, they click on it, and boom, they're in the right workspace with exactly the branch. They don't have to set that stuff up. And the same sort of thing happens when you do a pull request. You can do a pull request from within the IDE. The pull request gets sent over to GitHub or Bitbucket or whomever it is. But inside that pull request, guess what? It's a branch, and it has a workspace link dedicated to that. So each person who's clicking on those links doesn't have to worry about some of the Git or subversion specifics associated with working on that particular issue. And suddenly, wow, boom, I don't have to worry about setting up my dev infrastructure anymore. It's just part of my lifecycle. And if you get through all of that, you know, hopefully, you know, you like the technology well enough that you can then come to CodeEnvy, and CodeEnvy is an enterprise version of this that you can install behind the firewall, and that's how we make our money. And it's an enterprise version of Che that we come in and do for organizations that have really restricted or controlled environments on that.
Do you have any really – so it sounds like there's a lot that has gone into this, a lot of things behind the scene to make it work. Is there any one thing in particular that you look back and think, boy, that was a really, really difficult problem to solve? Any interesting stories there?
I think the most – so the hardest problem we've had to solve is around the two components. One is this idea that a workspace contains its own runtimes. And so, you know, essentially what this is like a platform as a service system. So you're running a Che server, and this Che server is, you know, is spawning off these workspaces that are going to run out into the cloud. And each of those workspaces have their own runtimes. And so then you have to deal with the lifecycle of start, stop, snapshot, recover. And at the same time, these workspaces and the what's running inside of them are defined by the developers. So we need to take the Docker files and the Compose files, extract them out so that the developers can edit them in a syntax that they can maintain and manage, but still hide the implementation details. That work has taken us years to get right, and we continue to work on that. The other thing is that developers are kind of picky. Yeah, and so the editor speed and the reaction of the keyboard and the key bindings, the when you're in a distributed situation, if you're going to interact with a browser, or even if you're interacting with your desktop IDE over SSH, there is a latency component. And so making it feel native is a tremendous amount of engineering work that goes into it. And the native editing experience itself is not such a big deal. That's pretty easy to do. But IntelliSense, where imagine as you're typing against code that has a huge project tree and all that's in the browser, and you're sending these deltas over to a workspace server, which is off in the cloud, and then the IntelliSense agent is off in the cloud as well and having to process that and get the results back. So if you're a developer and you want an autocomplete, you want that to be nearly instantaneous, even though it's a distributed operation here.
That does sound challenging. And I can imagine the frustration of starting to type something and, hitting tab or enter, whatever you're used to, and sitting there. Oh, and then finally it pops up. And you think, boy, I could have typed it in myself faster.
You could have done that, right? Yeah. So a lot of caching goes into it, right? Now, the good news is that the actual performance at scale can be better than localhost. And the reason being is that on localhost, you have a fixed amount of CPU and memory. And mm-hmm. and unless you're working for a company that gives you 32 or 64 gigabytes of RAM and 8 CPUs, most of us at home don't have machines like that. And so because your workspaces themselves, we can do intelligent things like by separating the code, the intelligent agents, all the different SSH agents and your runtimes onto different physical nodes out in the cloud on that. And so by distributing those resources, we can take advantage of things that are not available to your local hosts and actually increase speed over in certain scenarios.
Well, that's really fascinating. So as long as a developer has a reasonably low latency connection, they can be programming on the equivalent of a supercomputer when compared to a measly desktop or laptop. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's for this reason, by the way, that Amazon bought our largest competitor last year, which was a Cloud9 IDE. They're not open source, but they if you do the math, Amazon's all about monetizing the amount of compute that's out there. And if you think about all the developers on the planet and how much compute and memory they use to compile code, it's a lot of compute. And so there's a lot of money to be made in cloud vendors providing development environments.
Yeah. That's interesting. I want to ask something very different, kind of a psychology question. I'm always interested in how humans interact with new technology and the unintended consequences that we can find. So one of the things that open source has seen over the years is the difficulty in setting up a development environment kind of self-selects for good pull requests. Do you guys find that when someone moves over to something that is this easy, you see bad pull requests? One of the story that comes to mind, and I can't find the link to it, I was trying to look. Someone sends a pull request to Linus Torvalds for the kernel and says, I found all of these times where there's a typo. You guys accidentally repeated the word long, and you have long instead of just long. And so I got rid of all of those for you. And of course, anyone that knows C goes, thanks, but no, go away. Do you guys see anything like that with making this that easy?
Well, I find that unintended consequence story to be fascinating. I haven't seen anything like that. But what I have seen, which I think is a questionable concern, is that I think that there's a lot of value in the skills that a developer acquires in having to set up his development environment. It forces the developer to act like a sysadmin. And when you act like a sysadmin, there are just incredible skills around scripting and administration and operations that you pick up that you would never otherwise do. And that's just the nature of it. And by hiding all this stuff, we're encouraging people to not have those skills, or at least to delegate them to a very small number of people, the people who are maintaining the project itself. And so I worry about that and what that means for the quality of the developer population.
Of course, we've also said over the time that by getting rid of the fact that nobody's programming in assembly anymore, we're going to be losing all those skills to people who only know high-level languages. But there's always going to be a place for people at all the different levels of the environment and stuff, and there's plenty of room to specialize in our worlds. So I don't think that's going to be that big of an issue, but I appreciate you, you're respecting the concern. So I'm looking more now at this, because you mentioned Cloud9. Who else is in this space? And are they as far along as Eclipse Che is? And what's been the response then to another player coming along like Che?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that there are other players in this space, but they're all, they're not open source, and or they're cloud only systems, meaning that they're not software that you can install and run your own server with this. So I'm really impressed with Code Anywhere and Source Layer. And these are both products that are, think of them as kind of really advanced web-based versions of Sublime Text. So kind of more focused on the web editor experience and the individual developer experience on that. Che has noticeably taken a focus on teams and enterprises. We purposely are an installable server so that you can set up work groups, and also you can very shortly deploy directly onto Kubernetes or OpenShift, so it can be part of your microservices architecture at the same time. And these were the big vendors. Last year we had another vendor, Nitrous.io, and I think that Nitrous was really one of the earliest entrants into the market, and they just kind of went out of the business, and so they sunset their work. They were cloud only as well, and they went a different way on that. So, but what's interesting is that all these projects, all the major projects, Cloud9, CodeEnvy, Source Layer, CodeAnywhere, Nitrous.io, all started well over 4 years ago. So none of these projects are recent. They're all really long lived. They're all fairly well capitalized by venture capitalists. And so I say this as a reflection of I think that all of us, if you talk to the founders of these projects, we all completely underestimated the just amount of technology engineering that we were going to have to do to pull this off. We all started this because it was probably like hey, we know that cloud can solve certain problems, but the amount of engineering that has gone to get it to this point has been pretty tremendous. Here.
Have you seen big community response in the sense of, obviously the CodeEnvy guys worked on it more, the original design and the deployment, but have you seen the community then step up and provide some of the missing pieces in a way that maybe even surprised you?
Yeah, actually, surprisingly so. So in the case of SAP, so SAP embeds Che in HANA. So everybody who gets a HANA database has their own built-in IDE, and they actually went and wrote their own IDE. They replaced the one that we provided with their own, and it was more focused on HTML and database-driven GUI apps. So, wow. So they just filled that whole gap. That's one example. Red Hat has stepped up. I think they have like eight or nine full-time engineers working on Che. And they adapted Che so that instead of workspaces launching containers, workspaces interact with the OpenShift API and launch OpenShift pods for that. So now your workspace can be an OpenShift pod. So that's pretty tremendous. The guys at RogueWave, which were acquired by they were acquired by another company, but they're the PHP company. They make the Xen product. They came in and they wrote extensions and plugins for a PHP debugger, PHP IntelliSense with a language server. They refactored the editor. They did all the tutorials on that. And so it now matches their in many features to what their PHP IDE was. And it's all part of Che. They stood up and did that. Samsung, a big part of the project, they have an IoT platform called Arctic. It's under the Arctic brand. Think of it as a kind of an enterprise quality board for doing IoT applications, and it's got every little widget that you could imagine on there, and it runs a Linux OS. They built an Arctic IDE, a complete custom assembly that programs applications to be deployed on this board and this module. And that's just the quick highlights. Excuse me.
Bless you.
But you know, so like I said, there's about on the last major release there were 70 contributors, and of those 35 came from CodeNV. And so to me as a project leader, I'm really proud of that stat, because any time that you're a commercial entity that starts an open source project, if you can get more than 50% of the contributors to be entities that are not you're not part of, I consider that like you're actually quite as successful at that point. And so I'm really proud of that statistic. It's been a focus for us, and it will continue to be a focus for us.
And this has already been adopted as an Eclipse project, right? So the governance for it is now fully outside of your corporation?
Yeah. So it was adopted as an Eclipse project at the end of 2015. And what that means is that there's a intellectual property review. So they verify the copyright, they take ownership of the trademark, but all of the code goes through a lawyer review. So every code, all the dependencies, and it takes a significant amount of time. And this is why the Eclipse Foundation is a little bit smaller than other foundations like Apache or the Linux Foundation, because everything gets reviewed so that when it finally ships, you have a commercially friendly, completely legally verified set of IP that you can distribute and make use of out there. And so that we completed that process at the beginning of 2016.
Yeah. So clearly this thing works with Java, but can you describe some of the other environments that this works with? I mean, if you said PHP as one of the possibilities, but what about some of the other languages out there? Of course, I'm looking for Perl, but anyway, what are the other languages out there that this thing supports sort of out of the box or with plugins that I could install?
So what's interesting about it is that if you just want to do interpretation with syntax highlighting or compilation, you can do it with anything. And it could be a mobile app, a web app, and it could be any kind of language, Rust, Swift, Golang, pick your poison, because, there are Docker files for all these languages. And so as long as there's a Docker file for it, we can get the code in there. That means we can edit it and compile it and run it. Now, where it gets interesting, so the whole universe is out there, and we position it as a generic purpose workspace server. We're okay. Trying hard not to specialize in particular languages, but we are Java developers and Golang developers and JavaScript developers. So we do have some, things that we do specific to certain languages. Now, the way we handle that is we actually did this announcement about last summer with Red Hat and Microsoft around a protocol called the Language Server Protocol. And what the Language Server Protocol does is it takes these intelligence servers that every programming language has to provide autocomplete or document lookup, symbol lookup, whatever that is. There's hundreds of those things. And it creates a common JSON wrapper around that so that any IDE can make use of that utility. And we have been doing that work for both debuggers and IntelliSense agents. And so as long as these language servers support that protocol, it just drops right in as an agent into Che, and boom, you now suddenly get all this capability that you expect as a developer. Now, the language server protocol is pretty new, but there's about 20 languages that have either built a language server or committed to adapting to this protocol, including Emacs. As an IDE to adapt to it as well, by the way, on
yes.
that. But we're in the process. I think we've got like eight or nine of those currently deployed inside of Che, and about once a month we add one as well. And we'll eventually get it to be the point where it completely dynamic. You give us the language server, drop it in, and boom, you are activated with this capability.
I know that one of the recent things that the Dart team did was do something like that, where they rerouted or redesigned their interfaces to their debugger and their code completion engine. I'm wondering if that's the same protocol, or do you have a Dart plugin, or where's your path to that?
No, it's not the same protocol. What they did was a proprietary to Google there. Dart unfortunately doesn't have a language server according to this protocol at this point in time. I know. But we do have C#. We're working on C++. And we have JavaScript. We have Angular, I believe, in there.
Okay.
It's going to take a while. But the interesting thing is that there's a strong motivation from both IDE vendors and from language server providers to implement this. Because prior to this, if you're a language server provider, you had to customize your server for every freaking IDE. And it takes a long time. It takes months to do that, for one. So if you can just implement one JSON protocol and it drops into, it'll drop into VS Code, it'll drop into Eclipse Che, it'll drop into the Eclipse IDE. And I think that the JetBrains guys are going to work on it as well. So there's no reason for us in the future to need to have a lot of tools specific to just a single language. We'll still get those, and there's still benefit from them, but we don't need it as much.
Well, that sounds promising, and maybe as Eclipse Che takes more of the bandwidth or more of the mindset, that the Dart people will say, oh, wait a second, we probably need to at least have an adapter, if not actually go full hog on making it sort of fit in here. So where is this in terms of usability? Are we at production quality level now? Or are we still waiting? You said it's out of beta, I think you said. What's still missing? What are the big pieces that are still missing?
So this is a shipping product. We're fully supporting it. We support both the open source free usage and the commercial usage of it on premises as well. So it's out there, and we do stability releases every 2 weeks on it, and so we're pretty fantastic, pretty excited by that, and happy about it. The things that are missing, we have decent tools for Git and Subversion and editors, but they are not world class. So, when you get into a world-class editor, it's all about the key bindings. And when you get into a world-class Git capability, it's all about very sophisticated merge management, right, and diff management. So those are things that need to be improved. The other thing is that we have a lot more work to do with our basic command structure and goals. I think when you get into super advanced IDEs, instead of you saying, just compile this code, you start to give it goals, which is, I would like to take this project and deploy it into the cloud. And in order to do that, there is a whole series of dependency commands that you need to do along the way. And so doing that in a distributed environment, it adds a lot of complexity. And we'd like to get to that point where you just have this magical green button, and no matter what kind of source code you've got, if you've got a workspace and you've got the source code, you click the magical green arrow and we'll figure out everything that we got to do to get it to run on that in a distributed environment. And so that's goal-driven development, and that's a big area of focus for us on that.
We do have a live audience, small though it may be, and do have a couple of questions from them in our chat room. The first one is by Omid, and he wants to know, does Che support Scala, SBT, or Python?
Yes, and yes. Oddly enough, Scala is probably the most requested question we get on our GitHub forums. And I cannot for the life of me figure out why, but it is like more than anything else that comes up. Now, in the case of Scala, we don't have a language server for it, unfortunately, but it uses Java. So it can reuse the Java language server with that. And we have a stack that includes SBT. In it. Now, what we don't do is we don't do any automatic dependency analysis so that we can download dependencies automatically in the background. But we give you this really nice web terminal. It feels just like a Bash terminal that you've got. And so you can do everything on the command line there that you need to do.
Okay. You talked a little bit about having 35 of your 70 contributors were from other organizations. But that's impressive. But your company, what's your funding? What's your business model look like? How are you guys getting paid to work on this?
So we're a venture capital backed company. We created 4 years ago as the founder of that company. And so we've raised about $10 million in venture capital that has helped us invest into this. But we are a commercial operation as well. And we make money in three ways. The first way is that CodeEnvy and Che is a completely customizable system. You can take Che, rip out all the plugins and extensions that we got in there, add your own, and then repackage it into assembly and create a completely different customized developer workspace server. And so by doing this, this allows us to lean in and build relationships with important software vendors and partner with them to help them build specific products that they want to give to their customer base, rebrand it, different functionality, whatever that may be. And so that's an OEM business for us. And that business is really important for us because by working on those projects, it helps improve the overall core platform. It really, you know, gives us confidence that we're building the right product and that it, and then it gets a force multiplier because when our partner ships, it ships our technology out to a much broader base. And then our long-term business model is taking an enterprise version of Che, which provides scalability. You can run it on multiple nodes. It provides an authentication mechanism for it. There's a bunch of things that we do that make it an enterprise-grade solution. And you can install it behind the firewall or out at Amazon or Azure or Google, wherever it is. And we give that away for free for the first three users. So you can run CodeEnvy for three users on your own workgroup setting. And then for the fourth user and beyond, we sell that for $500 per user per year. So it's a license that you get. And then the third way is later this month in February or next month in February, we're going to be introducing a credit card model at CodeEnvy.io. Right now it's free. We've been giving it away completely for free. But CodeEnvy.io, we cap your RAM at 3 gigabytes and we have an idle timeout of 10 minutes. And that's really not conducive to all-day development. And so we'll let you buy more RAM. We'll let you set the workspaces to be always on. And there'll be like a small credit card fee for that. But our cloud system is not kind of our primary moneymaker. Our primary moneymaker is working with the software vendors and the enterprises with their big deployments on that.
And in fact, that actually leads right to my next question, which is how much of this, what features am I giving up if I'm only using just the open source part of this?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We get that question all the time. The workspace is identical between the commercial version and the open source version. So as a developer, my user interaction will be identical. There's no difference between the two. So what does differ is essentially operational elements. You know, if you're going to be running this at scale, you know, it provides backup and recovery built in. We've got this mechanism for how you add additional workspace physical nodes, and then we track that and manage the resources globally for you. It's got an integration mechanism on the commercial version so that there are adapters that we provide, commercial adapters, to make it easier to integrate with Jira or Bitbucket or whatever that whatever your tool may be on that. Uh-huh. And so when you get into a large organization that has development teams larger than 10 people and you're thinking about how to roll this out either department-wide or division-wide or corporate-wide, you know, suddenly having a platform to administer these workspaces as opposed to just having a workspace server becomes really important to you.
I can definitely see that, especially when I've seen how many times people have failed trying to scale something up that it starts out homegrown and then starts showing its organic nature, as in it starts rotting. So I could definitely catch that pretty easily. You know, we're almost out of time. I do have a couple more interesting questions. I hope they're interesting. In my mind, they're interesting. No, but I did know that one thing we haven't asked yet this entire show is, where did the name Che come from?
It's the name of the city where it was invented in the Ukraine.
Oh, okay. Well, that's simple. There is something much more in depth about it and fascinating about that.
You were thinking of some magical revolutionary in the past
probably.
History. Probably not. No.
No, not at all. It didn't come at all. Again, we're almost out of time. What haven't we asked? What's very important for our audience to be aware of that we haven't been able to get to yet?
What we haven't asked. Well, I think that your analysis has been spot on. I think that the question that we should ask is, how can other people get involved in the project? Because this is open source, and open source is all about contributions. Come experience the project. It's easy to install. You just Docker run Eclipse Che start, and you're suddenly running it. And then get involved. Help us add stacks, add new languages, you know, check the docs, become a contributor, because this is going to be the future. If development is important to you, cloud development will be our future. So, you know, come be a part of shaping that.
And I don't know if this is going to put you on the spot, but you did send me the link to your presentation you made last year. And one of the things you said in that was that you would actually make the Cloud NV platform available to selected open source projects. Are you still making good on that?
Yeah. So what we do for CodeNV, if you we have these buttons that you can do for your workspaces, and you provide this nice button on GitHub that will open a workspace for your particular project. We give you extra RAM for free for those users. So if you want your contributors to have this single button click, they click on it, it'll open your project, and then they get a bunch of RAM and everything that they need to do it. And that's a program that we still run, and we love it.
Wonderful, wonderful. I just wanted to make sure that people understood that there was a way to even get some leverage from your commercial side of your business for open source projects. I like that. That's really cool. Okay, two last questions, although I think I know the answer to both of these. Well, maybe not. Your favorite, what you would consider scripting language?
Bash.
Okay. That's close. That's fine. It's one of those I don't use, but that's great.
I used to be a Perl guy, but I'm just too old and I haven't used it enough. If you don't use it every day, then you start to get some plaque on the teeth.
It's true. Although I could recommend a couple good books. Anyway, and also your favorite text editor, but I think I know obviously the answer to that.
Right now, unfortunately, it's Sublime Text, but in the good old days, it was Emacs on it, right?
You don't Emacs consider
doesn't
the...
give me the nice doesn't give me the nice preview bar on the right.
Yeah. Okay. It's true. Although I do have a practical question, which is how one of the things I've been playing with JetBrains stuff to be able to do a Dart, and I'm having trouble even getting a handle on all the new escape sequences and function keys and stuff that I have to learn. I presume Eclipse has a similar growth curve. And is there any easy way to get started with that other than just like learning any language? It just takes time.
With the growth curve of learning about Dart or?
No, only about the Eclipse, the IDE.
Oh, Eclipse Che, the IDE?
Yeah. The text editor stuff, yeah.
The text editor stuff, you know, the best that we do right now is we give you a heads-up display. You know, you can press a key and, you know, we tell you what all the characters that are available to you at that point in time. But unfortunately, when it comes to key bindings, practice.
Yeah. I know. And I'm studying Spanish for 10 minutes a day.
You're thinking about the clarinet lessons that your mother made you do back in the day, right? That's, you know, practice.
Yes, in Spanish every day, or Spanish at least as often as I can, so I can speak a little bit better to that. Anyway, this has been wonderful. Great conversation, and I know there's probably some people now that are immediately going, what's the website and stuff? We have it all on show notes. Don't worry, it's eclipse.org/che. I can already see that people are going to be interested in what you've got going on here, and I may even play with it a little bit later or see if I can slide some of my customers over to something a little more unified like this. Sounds like you've done a real good job selling what you have. So thank you, Tyler, for being on the show today and talking about Che.
Thank you very much for having me.
Very cool. That was Tyler Jewell talking to us about Eclipse Che, one of those, real close to that. What do you think, Jonathan?
It sounds like a very interesting project. I enjoyed hearing some of the history about it with his personal struggles trying to get a development environment set up. And I know that can be an issue for someone first starting out or going to a new development environment or development style for the first time. So it's good that someone is looking at it, and it seems like they've got some really interesting ideas and techniques going on there. I think in my copious spare time, I will have to go and try to find a few moments to pull it up and play with it and see what it's all about. Particularly interesting is the concept. We passed by it quickly, but the idea that certain things, even though you have the latency of your internet connection, certain things actually happen more quickly in Eclipse Che than they would doing it locally because the server that you're connected to has so much more horsepower than your local desktop or laptop. And I just think that's very, very fascinating, a good unintended consequence, perhaps, of the cloud model.
Yeah, I bet they haven't tested it on a cruise ship, though. Nothing that happens quickly remotely on a cruise ship. So maybe there's something to be said for that as well. But sure. This is a very important scratch to itch. No, that doesn't make any sense. Itch to scratch. Here we go. I am not speaking English today. Apparently, I'm too much Spanish over the weekend. I even talked about it in, as I talked about how we're using localhost to develop for InSight cruises and also having to set up Vagrant or EC2 boxes for doing work for ZipRecruiter. Is it's so complex to get an environment that has all the pieces that we need. One of the things I could have easily got another hour on the show. So that's part of the problem. Always, we have some really deep projects we've been talking to recently, which is like, how do you deal with dev databases and things? You know, how do you deal with sample data that you can use while you're developing, but before you go live with real data and migrating all that stuff back and forth and keeping. Yeah, I'm sure the same problems all the way through, like keeping schemas in sync and things like that. But that is a whole another can of worms. Hopefully, Shay either solves it already or will solve it soon. And that's probably enough on that. Any last things before I can move on to the rest of the show?
No, it was a very interesting interview.
Awesome. So we have some shows lined up coming up. Next week, we've got Twine. We had Twine originally on the schedule back in, I believe it was November. Twine is an open source tool for telling interactive nonlinear stories. And what's cool about this is it's graphical. So a really smart UI built in JavaScript and SVG and things like that, where you basically can describe the, you're in a maze of twisty-tiny passages all like kind of stories. But you draw them in. You can say, well, if they have the scepter, they can go to the left here. Or if they need to find the gold, it's down to the right or whatever. And you can actually draw that in as part of your stories. Very, very cool. It's both a hosted solution and it's also a local solution. So there's Windows and OS 10 versions of it available for download, which is really cool. And also web-based versions as well. So we're going to bring them on next week to talk about that, the creator of Twine. And then following that, Gadgetron, medical image reconstruction. So you go to the doctor, you get an x-ray, they deliver it to you in electronic format these days, but most of those are viewable with proprietary technology. These guys are setting about to be able to view your own x-rays, your own medical imaging with open source software. Very cool. I could definitely have used some of that many years ago when I was doing all my x-rays for my arms and things like that. Arduino, going to have another guest back from a long, long time ago. Arduino first talked to us in 2009. So that was a number of years back. A lot of stuff's happened since then to Arduino, so they're going to be visiting us. Still have a few open slots left in Q2. I'll be filling those. If you go to twit.tv/floss, the homepage for this show. The big spreadsheet is linked from there. I mean, you can see my progress on that. Still booking those Q2 things. If you have any suggestions that aren't on that list, please let me know. And the way you let me know is you talk to the project leader or community coordinator and have them email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My email address is up there on that website, on that webpage. We have a live stream. We took a couple questions from there, 9:30 a.m. Pacific time. That's when we tape on Tuesdays at live.twit.tv. I try to also announce that on Google+. So we do have a Google+, also Floss Weekly on Google+. That also tweets over to at Floss Weekly over on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google+. And also on Facebook, apparently, because it's where the deer picture was. And also Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter and a few other places as well. I am definitely going to be at Scale coming up in a few weeks. That's the Southern California Linux Expo. I'm going to be hunting for new guests to fill my schedule with. I'm also going to be at YAPSE, yet another Perl conference, over in the East Coast somewhere. I forget exactly where. OSCON in Austin just got confirmed for that I will be there as representing press, again, representing Floss Weekly. Hopefully also DragonCon, still waiting to hear back on that. And VisLay, the big conference in Porto Alegre, Brazil, hoping to be all those places. If you see me at one of those, please come up, say hello, and say, listen to Floss Weekly, watch Floss Weekly. Really appreciate what you do for that. Also, if you have potential guests, let me know. Definitely cool. Anything you want to plug there, Jonathan?
Well, I seem to always find myself at these little tiny niche conferences. March 1st and 2nd, I'm going to a FPGA verification conference in the D.C. area. I doubt any of our listeners will be interested in that one. But if you want to follow me and get updates on that and everything else, it's JP_Bennett at Twitter.
Very, very cool. And Jonathan, thanks once again for stepping up and making your schedule available. But as you said, it's probably like the default state, so that's good. But thanks once again for beaming into us from good old flyover state of Oklahoma. Appreciate that.
Yep. Anytime.
Very cool. Very cool. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.